Thanks for joining us on The Record. I'm Jeannie Yandel in for Bill Radke. And we're asking you what you want to do about the Lenin statue in Fremont and why. But before we get to that, we have something else to figure out. We have to figure out what to do with the foreign invader that showed up in our water while we were all looking at the solar eclipse. More than 300,000 Atlantic salmon escaped pens at a fish farm off the coast of Cypress Island near Anacortes. And now scientists, tribes, state officials have to grapple with what to do. And we're going to talk with one of those people now. Ron Warren is the head of the fish program for the Washington State Fish and Wildlife Department. Hi, Ron. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Jeannie. Thanks for having me.
So how did this happen?
So our understanding is with the solar eclipse came some pretty severe tidal exchanges, and within the San Juan Island structure themselves, those currents are pretty strong at times, which caused anchor to pull loose and then it allowed some walkways to twist and become unsafe for workers on the net pen structures of Cook Aquaculture up at Cypress Island.
And Cook Aquaculture is the name of the fish farm where the Atlantic salmon escaped.
Yes, ma'am.
So what problems could these Atlantic salmon create for our own native salmon populations?
So far, we don't know and don't believe that they'll cause a problem other than the competition that they'll create with the ESA-listed Chinook and steelhead in the area. So they are going to eat food that the other salmon would have had, and they may compete in a spawning environment once they go to fresh water. So they're not normally found in fresh water environments, and that's not a good situation. But so far, we don't have documentation that they've ever been successful spawning or crossbreeding with other species of salmon. So that's a good thing.
It's a good thing that they can't crossbreed with our native salmon populations. Why not?
Correct. Well, it's a good thing because we don't want the genetic makeup of our Pacific Ocean salmon to be altered by the Atlantic salmon that have been released. And we don't want the Atlantic salmon to create their own locally adapted stock of fish that could take hold. So them not having the ability to spawn successfully in the wild is a good thing, at least on the West Coast.
Well, Ron, I'm sure that you're familiar with some of the concerns that the Lummi tribe has raised about this. They've said that farmed Atlantic salmon could do some more harm to our wild salmon. The Atlantic salmon might be diseased, for example. Why is that not a big concern for you right now?
It's always a concern, Jeannie. I think that the information is getting out slowly. We have had investigations into fish health on these fish. These fish went to the marine environment in May of 2016. Their last antibiotic treatment was in July of 2016 and have been very healthy since that time. You don't want a farm-reared Atlantic salmon to mingle or try to spawn or compete against any Pacific Ocean salmon. The intent is that the company raises these for human consumption and sells them. And they normally have very high success rates and survival rates for that particular product. Just in this case, it didn't work out that way.
Well, one of the things that Washington Fish and Wildlife is telling people they can do to help is to go fishing. Just go out, catch as many Atlantic salmon as you can. If I wanted to do that, where would I go? Where should I go to do that?
So we know that the Lummi tribe have in their commercial fisheries caught some of the Atlantic salmon, so we know that they're north as far as Bellingham Bay. So anywhere in that San Juan area structure towards the freshwater areas, I'm going to say from the Snohomish to the Nooksack Rivers, you might have a likelihood of catching. I also make the assumption, because of reports that we have of fish jumping in the Cypress Island area, that you still may be able to hook and line a fish there. So a legal salmon license allows you to catch and keep Atlantic salmon, regardless of size and regardless of the total number. And there's no requirement for reporting on our catch record card. There's no location for Atlantic salmon on the catch record cards, as we normally don't have them in our waters.
So I could catch, but I don't necessarily have to report the catch?
Correct.
Okay. Well, we heard from a fisherman who said that these Atlantic salmon might not actually be safe to eat. Even if I do catch them, I might not want to eat them. That hatchery fish, for example, that they have to be weaned off antibiotics that they're fed, and that there should be some cautions out there, not encouragement to go fishing. So if I catch these fish, can I eat them? Are they safe to eat?
They should be. As I had said earlier, the last antibiotic treatment was in July of 2016. That treatment is far gone from the fish's system in over a year that it's been in that marine environment. These fish were legal to take to a harvest location. You should be able to catch and keep and consume the Atlantic salmon that are in the marine environment.
Well, Ron, earlier you said that information is coming in kind of slowly. So what are the big questions that you have about what happened with this salmon escape, with this big spill where all of these salmon managed to escape?
Yeah, and I think our big question right now is, we know that the total population in the net pens was just over 300,000, and Cook Aquaculture, the company that has this operation, is trying to inventory fish that they have remaining in net pens that may have died in the collapse of the net pen structure. And then we've also permitted them to go into the area with small skiff boats and try to net up some of the fish that might be in the local area. We've done that in coordination with NOAA Fisheries and communicated that with the Northwest Indian Fish Commission. So that they can, A, remove the fish, as many as they can, that benefits us from those fish being in the wild, allows them to recapture product. We're not allowing them to keep any other types of salmon because of possible ESA concerns for their activity. So that's the piece. We're waiting for the inventory to be complete on how many fish may have really escaped from the net pen structure.
Well, one other unknown as of this morning was whether Cook Aquaculture was going to face any penalty for the fish spill. And you told the Seattle Times that was under evaluation. Have any decisions been made yet?
Not yet.
Okay. Ron Warren is the head of the fish program for the Washington State Fish and Wildlife Department. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Jeannie.
Coming up in about a minute, we are also going to figure out what to do about the Vladimir Lenin statue in Fremont. If you have thoughts on what we should do and why, give us a call. We're at 206-543-5869. That's coming up in just about a minute on The Record. It's KUOW. I'm Jeannie Yandel in for Bill Radke.
Marxism has got to go. Hey, hey. Ho, ho. Marxism has got to go. Hey, hey. Ho, ho.
That's supporters of President Trump protesting Seattle statue of Vladimir Lenin. And it's not just Trump supporters pushing to remove the statue. Mayor Ed Murray says he wants it to come down, too.
You know, that monument represents to many people in the city their families having been murdered, the destructions of tens of millions of people. If I were Eastern European American or a Jewish American, I'm not sure how I'd feel about that monument. So I think it's time for these things to go. They don't represent the best of who we are.
That's Ed Murray talking with Q13 Fox. And it's not really clear how much the mayor can do about the Lenin statue. It's been on private property for over 20 years. But we'd love to know what you think about the Lenin statue. Is it art? Is it, as Mayor Murray said, a painful reminder of a dictator? We'd love to know what you think. Give us a call at 206-543-5869. We have a guest in the studio with us. You agree with Mayor Ed Murray, Yulia Shadiria. You're a math teacher in the Snohomish School District, and you grew up in Ukraine. You moved here with your family when you were 15 years old. What did you think about Vladimir Lenin when you were growing up?
That's correct. I grew up in Soviet Ukraine, and as your listeners probably know, back then Lenin was our idol. He was our leader. He was our chief. He was almost like a god to us, children who grew up in Soviet Union, to most children. And I, as a child, idolized him just like most other children did. There is a little anecdote that I have. I was going to a swimming pool when I was about 7, 8 years old, and I needed to jump into the water, and I was really afraid to jump. However, I thought to myself, imagine Lenin, Stalin, all of those people standing here and watching you, how embarrassing it would be, how shameful if you couldn't make that jump. So show that courage and jump in the water. And that actually made me jump. I guess that tells you a little bit about how I felt about Lenin when I was growing up.
He loomed very large in your consciousness, it sounded like. At what point did you start questioning that, I guess, that godlike status you described for him?
Yes, I personally didn't even have a chance to question it. However, Soviet Union started falling apart. And in the beginning of 90s, I was to become a young pioneer. It's Young Pioneers was the youth organization statewide, which worthy students would join when they were about 8 years old. And I was very excited about it. And, you know, as I was putting on my red scarf, my mom and I was repeating the sort of like a pledge of allegiance to Lenin and communism that we were supposed to memorize by heart. My mom said, maybe you should not repeat that, you know. And I was like, why? I've been waiting for this moment. This is very, you know, honorable thing. And she said, well, maybe just you don't know everything just yet. And at that moment in history, Soviet Union was falling apart, and the truth about horrific mass murders, killings, repressions was coming out. And later I understood, as I was watching documentaries on TV or as friends or relatives were reciting the stories of repressions and how many people were just executed on the spot, how many thousands of people were just killed and tortured, and villages were exterminated, including women and children, if they dared to uprise against Bolsheviks. That is when I definitely kind of said, okay, well, I'm going to put this whole Lenin thing behind for now, and I guess I moved on.
Hmm. Well, you came here to the Northwest. When did you find out that we have a statue of Lenin in Fremont? When did you learn about that statue?
You know, I don't remember the exact time. However, I do remember it was some sort of a scavenger hunt. We either did with our school or work or college. We were running around Seattle and trying to find all the memorable places, like the Troll, the Pike Place Market, right? And there was a statue of Lenin on there as well. And when I saw it, I was surprised and a little bit disappointed too, kind of coming from that background, from after all the documentaries I watched, after all the photos I saw of the executed, I was like, whoa, there's a Lenin statue here, right here in America, in Seattle, the land of the, you know, free and capitalist economy and all that. So that was surprising.
So you were surprised, you were a little disappointed. Do you still feel that way?
Yes, kind of. I guess I can't say that I'm walking every day offended by it or anything like that, but it is a little bit surprising. I've heard people say, well, it's more like an art piece. We kind of decorate it. We kind of have fun with it. And I can see their point, but at the same time, knowing things that I know, it seems that there is not enough kind of education and knowledge behind what that person is. And it's kind of making a light of a situation. For example, what I would like to say to those people, imagine a statue of Hitler, right, being standing out in the open, even though it's a private property, as I understand, being kind of played with the same way. Would we be as accepting of that?
Well, we got a lot of feedback on Facebook over this question, what to do about the Lenin statue. And It's interesting to think about for people who have walked past the statue and not really considered Vladimir Lenin's legacy the way you're talking about. But one of our listeners, Percy, writes that it's true, Lenin was a beast, but the statue is used by many artists to remind us of the perpetually blood-soaked paws of the founder of the Soviet state. What do you have to say to Percy, who's arguing that we keep this statue up as a reminder of exactly what you're talking about?
I would have to say that maybe I'm not as knowledgeable about how it is being used. I would gladly accept the statue in a museum in an appropriate context. Let's say it was surrounded by the photos of hundreds of bodies with their genitals being turned inside out, with their skin on their hands being peeled, with scalps being removed, and that is all the context in which this statue is standing. The information, statistics on how many people were killed and his legacy, his bloody legacy that unveiled through the years of communist regimes all over the world, not just Ukraine. I would be absolutely okay with that and accepting of that. So maybe I do not know what it is. The way it is right now, is it just kind of being decorated to make kind of fun? I don't think it's enough to just kind of have fun with it, because people driving by, walking by, they might not understand what the legacy is, that terrorist legacy behind that person.
Well, Yulia, we did hear from another listener, Sarah, who points out that when the Vladimir Lenin statue is decorated, it's decorated for Christmas. It's used in kind of a satirical way. And the goal there, one of the goals anyway, is to minimize his legacy and to sort of cast disdain on who he was. And in no way is it a respectful statue. It doesn't show respect and people don't treat it respectfully. What do you think of that idea, that this statue might serve as a way to minimize Lenin's legacy?
Well, think about same situation with a Hitler statue. Let's put a Hitler statue up, decorate it for Christmas, dance around it. I don't know. Sing Christmas carols around it. It seems like it is minimizing the legacy, but it also minimizes the huge sacrifice that was put at the feet of that person.
Hmm. Well, that
is my fear.
You talked about how you could see the statue remaining up if his legacy were contextualized. But absent that happening, I mean, you know where the statue is in Fremont.
Yes.
It stands, in front of a falafel place. What should we do? Should we take it down? Do you agree with Mayor Murray?
Well, I would like to say that I'm just trying to be a voice for Ukrainian community here. I'm not very familiar with what Mayor thinks about it in depth, or what his, you know, political stance is. Neither am I connected to the protests that just happened recently. I hope it was peaceful, but I'm just trying to, and I'm not advocating anything illegal like vandalism or violence or anything like that. I'm just trying to bring our point across. This is how we feel. Okay, this is what we think when we look at that person. This is the legacy behind it. And if there's a legal way to remove it, I would advocate for that, yes.
Yulia Shadiria, thank you so much for coming in and talking with us about this.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're talking about the Vladimir Lenin statue in Fremont, in Seattle's Fremont neighborhood. We're having a conversation about whether it should remain up or whether it should come down. You can give us a call with your thoughts at 206-543-5869. That's 206-543-5869. Marcy Silman, KUOW's arts reporter, what does that Lenin statue, how does that connect with the rest of Seattle's kind of, I think of two things when I think of sort of our public art legacy. I think of our sense of quirkiness, or at least how we like to publicly display a sense of quirkiness, and our sense of kind of, you know, not taking serious things seriously. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that the Lenin statue, you have to take separate from Seattle's public art legacy, because it was privately purchased and privately installed. So that aside, I think listening to Yulia talk about this, it made me think, first of all, about the power of art and the power of public spaces and how we consider what goes in them. The two county and city programs that do fund public art have panels that talk about what's going to be there. And my guess is that this statute would not have passed muster. And yet it's also integral to this, at least the historic sense that Fremont had of itself. I think Fremont has changed. There's also Waiting for the Interurban. There's a statue of a clown that got put just down the street from Waiting for the Interurban. So the community itself and the troll, the community itself has an array of very tongue-in-cheek artwork that is embraced in other ways. So I think setting aside the official policies for how official publicly funded art is cited and decided upon, this is an interesting question. But really what I wrote down as Julia was talking was, wow, art is really powerful. Monument is really powerful. And it's something we take for granted.
Well, we've got Susie Burke with us as well. She's the president of the Fremont Dock Company. She's also a major booster of all things Fremont. Susie, you've been involved with the shaping of Fremont over the last 20 years. So why does that neighborhood...
Oh, heck, a lot more than 20 years. Are you kidding? You can put in a thimble what we've been able to do in the last 20 years.
Should I say something sort of a little less specific? Okay, so I'll do the public radio non-specific thing. For several decades, Susie Burke has been involved with the shaping of the Fremont neighborhood. So why do we need that particular statue in that neighborhood? Why do we still need the Lennon statue?
Well, we don't. It's for sale, and it's been for sale since it went up, but bear in mind where it went up for sale and how it got here. The story of Lennon is fantastic as a statue. The statue was built for a town in Yugoslavia that commissioned an artist who came from here. And he, when his statue was taken off its 18-foot pedestal there, was bereft that his piece of art was going to get melted down, and another art lover from Issaquah decided to buy it and bring it over. It ends up in Fremont simply because the Arts Foundry was here. They made it from eight pieces of bronze into a statue and said, oh, can we display this somewhere so somebody might want to buy it? Because the poor guy that brought it over happened to die in an automobile accident. And his mother ends up with this statue that she can't use. So we put it in our flea market. And even the New York Times, which isn't long on humor sometimes, but they got the humor of Lennon sitting in the corner of a... on a piece of my property where we had every Sunday the flea market with a big sign around its head, for sale, $150,000. And in small print it said, or best offer. And that lasted around the world. I mean, Lennon got a lot of more than tongue-in-cheek poke at that one. And it then floated around the community right down to the Pioneer Square art walk thing Thursday nights and whatnot on the back of a Ballard Transfer flatbed, laying down the statue is hollow. People got a good chance to look at how a piece of art that we never see things of this size and dimension done here in the United States, because we're looking at stuff that's 200 years old. And this goes back to a way of making statuary that's much older than that. Anyway, when it ended up on this particular little person's piece of property here in Fremont, it is not on a pedestal. It sits on the plain concrete, and it looks like it's walking towards Ballard. The guy has a very, very dismal look on his face. This was not a complimentary statue. It's Lennon walking out of fire and rockets. And underneath his feet, right at the front of the thing, is the Mayor Norm Rice's signature scrawled in the concrete. Even Norm Rice got the humor of this.
Well, I have to ask, Susie, I mean, this was, this was back in the early 90s. I mean, is it time to maybe revisit?
But
you're talking about
a
joke that's 20 years old at this
point.
Yeah,
but this is our Cold War memories. We've got a rocket from Korea. We've got the biggest piece of the Berlin Wall in the United States. We don't throw these things away, but I will tell you about every piece of art in Fremont, including Waiting for the Interurban. The Arts Council, the Arts Commission of Seattle never accepted any of mm-hmm. them. We, all of these things have been pieces that nobody else would display, so we decided that if we could do it quite on the cheap, out in the and the public, people would get to poke at it. And we get more poking per statue than probably any place else in the city. People interact with these things. That statue has had a pink tutu on it. It has had a pumpkin on its head pretty much every Halloween since it went in there. It has been totally wrapped in foil. It quite often has a burrito in its hand. It has definitely had a shopping bag at Christmas time, and at Christmas time it gets a great big blue Jewish star on its head and a bunch of draping of neon lights, so that we can have Festivus underneath it. It is a joke that everybody interacts with, and we let anybody put a sign there that says, do you realize this guy? And there's been signs there. This guy killed, you know, and then somebody brings a sign that says, but the Chinese communist guy killed twice as many, you know, things like that.
Susie, this is Marcy. I have a question about how the community, do you collectively talk about the all the public art that does come into the neighborhood?
Oh, yeah, we used to have a committee called ARF, the Artistic Republic of Fremont. That's the one that put up Lennon. But, I mean, just recently we put up J.P. Patches
right.
and Gertrude, and again, that's a statue that people wanted to build and wanted to have, but the city, the Seattle Center turned it down. The Art Commission wasn't interested. And Son of a Gun, we said, hey, where do you want to put it? We'll figure it out.
So essentially you're saying that this is art that reflects the community.
Oh, well, the community likes quirky things. Oh,
right.
And by the rocket that's over here pointed at City Hall came off of a salvage GI salvage place downtown that was being torn down. No one probably in the last 10 years even knows it was ever there. But to us, it was the place where you turned on Battery Street and came out towards Fremont.
Well,
I mean, all of these things have something associated with them that probably isn't about Russia.
I have to ask, though, Susie, you just heard from Yulia Shadiria. She's a member of the community, too.
I mean, about it.
Well, but let's, I mean, perhaps we don't take the statue down, but what about putting a plaque up? Something more permanent than just somebody putting up a sign.
Hey, anyone wants to come with a plaque, we'll put it up.
Okay. We also
we got the first $100 that paid to just do the concrete work under it came from the Seattle Communist Party. So the Seattle Republican, believe it or not, we had a Republican Party at that time, said, well, we'll match it. I mean, everybody was talking in the 90s about the fall of the Berlin Wall. We thought we were pretty on it when we got the biggest piece of the Berlin Wall. And do you know why it came here? It came here because Seattle wouldn't give them their time of day, and they wanted to honor the Boeing guys who made that Berlin airlift work. And there were guys killed flying in and out of Berlin to keep those people fed. Don't even begin to think that my generation doesn't know about communism. We know, and we laugh at it, because we're here and it's not.
Fair enough. And I hear you when you say that you are okay with a plaque if somebody wants to add a plaque. We also had a suggestion from Chase on Facebook. He says that he loves the statue, but Lennon himself is a dicey figure to see celebrated publicly. So what if we kept the statue and replaced the head with somebody uncontroversial like Cisco Morris, the celebrity TV gardener? What do you think about that? Cisco's face,
I've
Lennon statue?
I've told people that for years. Buy it, melt it down, make a statue of someone you like better and bring it back. We'll put it up somewhere. Yeah. I say that to John Carlson all the time.
Susie Burke.
Believe me, I've taken more ribbing about that statue than anybody you want to notice walking around in Seattle. But art outlasts politics. Thank God.
Susie Burke, that is a really interesting place to end with. Thank you for coming on and talking with us about the Lenin statue. We really appreciate it.
You bet. Take care.
So, Marcy Silman, arts reporter for KUOW, you just heard Susie's last thought. You nodded. What do you think about this?
I think art does outlive politics, but I have to flash on all those marble monumental statues that were made in ancient Rome, and I'm sure Nero exists somewhere in some museum that I don't know about. It's interesting who we choose to celebrate and how we regard things that maybe have different meanings in different historical contexts. The question about monuments in general, Confederate monuments, Lenin, what have you, is do we rip down everything that we don't agree with, or do we contextualize it? Do we leave it up? I mean, these symbols are really powerful, and we're seeing how powerful and the kind of antipathy across the country that has resulted in violence when we talk about removing sculptures. If the community of Fremont would put it all to a vote and everybody agreed that they wanted to keep it, do we let them keep it? Do we speak for them? I mean, I don't know where the line is drawn, Jeannie, and the line between censorship of art and artists and free speech is fine. Fine line.
Well, we have a couple of callers on the line who want to get into this question of what we should do about this statue. We've got Michael, who's calling from Fremont. Michael, what do you think? Do we leave the Lenin statue up? Do we take it down?
Yeah, I think we should leave the statue up. I mean, it's something that has been there ever since I grew up in the neighborhood. And I think it serves as a good reminder of the lessons of the Russian Revolution, the history of Lenin and Trotsky during that time, especially, you know, 100 years later, almost to the date.
Do you think the statue on its own, though, really serves to help people better understand that legacy? I mean, you heard Yulia's argument that the statue on its own doesn't really tell anybody anything. There's nothing there explaining who Lenin was or what he did.
Well, I mean, It certainly is being used in different contexts. A lot of people have taken it into different meanings since then. But it opens a conversation. I mean, clearly we're having a conversation right now. I knew nothing about Lenin until, you know, I saw that statue and I asked, you know, who is that? And as I've grown up, especially people in my generation are very fond, very popular with socialism. And so it's important that we study the history of socialism, the history of previous revolutions, to understand how do we position ourselves today. You know, what do we learn from Marxist-Leninism? You know, what do we learn from the Russian Revolution and how it failed, the counter-revolution? Something that we need to keep in mind is that a lot of people falsely conflate the legacy of Lenin with the legacy of Stalin. Lenin is not responsible for, you know, the millions of deaths that a lot of people blame on the communist regime of the Soviet Union. And Stalin wasn't even able to come to power until after Lenin had died. If Lenin hadn't died, I think you're looking at a very different course of history in Russia.
Thank you so much for that phone call, Michael. We've also got Matt in Bremerton on the line. Matt, what do you think about this question? What should we do about the Lenin statue in Fremont?
Well, my thoughts are this. If I'm an artist who likes to paint nudes and natural surroundings, should I be allowed to have my models in public parks and public spaces? I think there's a reason we take controversial matters and issues, as well as statues, and place them in a setting where those who want to view them still have access, yet we don't offend those who are trying to rise above the current times of Charlottesville and the divides, the racial divides, the sexual divides that we have in this country. I'm not advocating destroying it, but we should rise to the higher level for the common good.
All right, Matt, thank you so much for that phone call. Nick is in the University District. He's waiting to weigh in on this, too. Nick, what do you think? What should we do about the Lenin statue?
Yeah, well, I'm not sure I know what we should do, but I just wanted to share a story. I was traveling in England, and I actually met a man who heard I was from Seattle, and the first thing he said was, "Is there a Lenin statue in your city? I've heard of that place." And I said, "Yeah." And he had actually watched the statue we have in Fremont get taken down from his village in Yugoslavia. And he just talked about how powerful of a moment that was for him, you know, and it was just burned in his memory. And that's all he knew of our city. And so when I came back to Seattle after traveling, it very much transformed the way I viewed that statue on the corner there. And so I think going back to what, you know, sort of the debate a little bit between Ulia and Susie, you know, I think there might be a middle ground, because I think having context for that statue might be a great way to remember, you know, the tragedies that did happen in so many lives. But also it is a point of conversation and sort of communal commentary that I think might be worthwhile having there, as long as we can give it some context so that we're not forgetting, you know, the powerful and negative emotions that might come for so many who see that statue.
You raise an interesting point, because those of us who've been around Seattle long enough know that part of the reason that statue came here was the people of Yugoslavia, first of all, it's no longer Yugoslavia, throwing off their communist history. So the toppling of statues like that all around the former Soviet republics and affiliated countries was very meaningful to them, that they were seeing freedom for themselves. The fact that it comes here, those of us who remember when it came, know that history and have that context in our memories. For newcomers to the city, it may be something else and mean something else. So maybe the context isn't necessarily pictures of bodies with their scalps and skin taken off, as Julia suggested, but something that reminds us of the moment that it entered into our city.
Nick, thank you so much for that story. That reframes this debate in my mind. It hadn't occurred to me that this was about both sides basically saying, your memory is too short. You don't remember this. And this, for some people, is how the statue arrived in Fremont. This, for others, is who Vladimir Lenin was and what his legacy was. That's an interesting thing to consider as we keep having this conversation about what to do with that statue. Marcy Silman, KUOW Arts Reporter, thank you for coming in and talking with us about this.
Always a pleasure, Jeannie.
How are you going to think about that statue when you walk past it now?
I see that statue frequently, and it has become just part of the scenery, but I think this conversation does make me think about my longevity in the city and makes me, again, I'm very thankful that art is so powerful that it evokes conversations like this. So always, art does outlive politics, as Susie Berg said. I'm with her on that.
Marcy Silman from KUOW's newsroom talking about art and politics. And listeners, we have one more question for you. If you had to choose a piece of music or literature or even a greeting in some human language to go out to the rest of the universe, what would you choose? We'll look at the choices that scientists made back in 1977 when they designed the so-called golden record. That's back in a minute when KUOW's record returns. Welcome back to The Record from KUOW. I'm Jeannie Yandel in for Bill Radke. Now, if you could send any human creation out into the universe, what would it be? This was the question NASA scientists asked themselves in 1977. And with the help of Carl Sagan, a science writer, a record producer, they put a whole bunch of messages in different languages, sounds of nature, music like this. That That, ladies and gentlemen, is Chuck Berry, one of the musicians who made it onto what's called the Golden Record. 8 copies of the so-called Golden Record were made, 2 went into space, and scientists hoped someone or something out in the universe might find one and listen to it or de-encode it, see what was on there. Joe Janes considers the Golden Record to be one of the most important letters in history. He's an associate professor at the University of Washington and the host of the podcast Documents That Changed the World. Hi, Joe.
Hi.
So how did the Golden Record Project even come about? It sounds really improbable.
It sounds really improbable because it kind of just happened. This is one of those, hey, we're going to send probes out into space. Hey, maybe while we're doing that, there was actually a tradition. There had been a couple of probes sent. The Pioneer probes had been sent a few years before, and it had a plaque. That's the plaque with the naked man and woman on it, which people were all bent out of shape about in the early 70s. So they're going to send more probes out to explore all the outer planets and then shoot off into space. And it appears to be people just thought, hey, we should stick something on the side of this thing. And the more they thought about it, the more elaborate it became. And then it became, we can send a record album. Oh, that means we could send music. Oh, that means we could send pictures. And then it just sort of went on from there.
Hmm. Well, how did scientists put it together? How did they decide what got on the Golden Record and what didn't?
Well, that's yet another, hey, what do you think kind of thing. This wasn't official. This wasn't, you know, the head of NASA saying, okay, we're going to stick records on the side of this. You all go figure out what it is. It's a very Carl Sagan 1970s kind of idea. And for those of us who grew up watching and reading and listening to Carl Sagan, it's completely him. And he was the instigator behind it. He was head of the Planetary Society in the 70s, and he formed a group, a small group of scientists, even a couple of science fiction writers, some music experts and so on. And it was all very happenstance, like, I don't know, what do you think? And, oh, we should have this, and, oh, we should have that, and we only have this much time, so we have to be really careful, and yeah.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, you're sort of describing it as this very loose sort of, what do you think about this song? What do you think about this? But they had less than 6 months, like they had a deadline.
Yeah.
So what kind of decisions did they have to make because of the deadline?
Yeah, there was actually, they wanted spoken greetings, and they approached the UN, which turned out to be a bad idea, but they approached the UN, and the UN said, well, we'd have to have a meeting about it, and the meeting's in June, but the rocket was going to be shot off in the summer before, and, you know, could you hold the launch for us to have this meeting? And yeah, that wasn't going to fly. So it was all very, okay, we got 6 months, we want to do this. They made the most of that. They made a lot of decisions on the fly. There was a lot of, hey, you know, I know somebody who knows somebody who knows about Indian music. Let's do that. Or, you know, let's get the people at the foreign language departments at Cornell to record the greetings because the UN is just more trouble than they're worth. It was lots of decisions like those.
Well, and I read a New Yorker piece by a science writer who helped Carl Sagan kind of pull some of these things together for the Golden Record. And he said that copyrights came into this as well. They wanted to use some music by the Beatles and, you know, there were issues there. There were just all kinds of weird permissions issues as well.
Yeah. The Beatles agreed to Here Comes the Sun, but the record company wouldn't. Here Comes the Sun, what better Beatles song would there be to sing? I did love the fact that they did, once they chose the music and got the recordings, they did pay royalties for the records they fabricated to send into space. So the rights holders got several cents apiece for the records that are going to be, that have been sent out for all eternity, which has got to be one of the better copyright deals ever made. but a lot of stuff was they made the decisions they made because of what they could get. And they also were trying really, really hard to be representative. Sagan and a bunch of other people wrote a book afterwards that talked about the process, and they have maps of all the places where the music came from to show that it was all over the world, and countries that were represented by the spoken greetings, and it represented something like 90% of the human population. They were trying really hard to tell as big a story as they possibly could in the limited time and resources they had available. And, you know, people disagree, and, oh, why is there no Irish music? They discovered at the very end there was no Irish music, and Tip O'Neill was Speaker of the House, and apparently that was a problem, but it was too late. So there's no Irish music on the record. And there you go.
If my mother is listening to this, I apologize. There is no Irish music on the Golden Record.
And my grandfather.
Well, I think about what this record was for, or I guess, you know, these two copies of this record, and it's just extraordinarily slim odds, right? That one, there is extraterrestrial life, and two, that extraterrestrial life would find the record, and then three, they would be able to use the record, that they'd be able to play the record. I mean, did scientists really think that someone would find this?
They operated as though they did. But there's also a lot of evidence from the time they were doing it that the audience was in-house. This was for us. And the shooting it into space was almost secondary. I mean, that was clearly the point. There's lots of, well, it's highly unlikely this is ever going to be found because it's not shot in any particular direction. No exoplanets had yet been discovered, so they had no particular direction in which to shoot it. Plus, the point of the mission was to go around the planet, so it would, whatever direction it happened to go, as it shot around Neptune, that sort of thing. If it ever got found, the Star Trek movie, first Star Trek movie notwithstanding, we all know what in fact happens to Voyager from the first Star Trek movie. Would other beings even be able to perceive that there is a record on there and what it is, even though there's instructions on how to play it and there's a stylus and all the rest of it? It seems unimaginably unlikely that it would ever be intercepted and understood. And if it ever was, we'd never know it. Hopefully. There's all sorts of Twilight Zone to serve man aspects to this. And at least a couple people were concerned that we were giving away our position. So maybe this wasn't the best idea in the world, which I just think is, including the Astronomer Royal, said, you really shouldn't do this.
Huh.
And Arthur C. Clarke said that the message that I put on it would be for future humans, in case any future humans found it. And the message should be, please leave me alone and let me go on. Because the point of this is to go on for all eternity.
I'm talking with Joe Janes. He's an associate professor at the University of Washington, host of the podcast Documents That Change the World. And you just listed off several kind of fascinating things about this golden record, what it was for, what it wasn't for, who thought it was a good idea, who didn't think it was a good idea. The records themselves were designed to be readable for a billion years, from what I understand. I mean, the fact that they were ever made is just amazing. What's the most fascinating thing to you about the golden record?
The fact that it even exists, what would we do today? This is a mid-1970s Carl Sagan idea.
Mm-hmm.
And who would step up today to do this? How would they do it? And what message would they send? If you read, for example, President Carter's message, he uses words like, if we survive, we are trying to survive our time to live into yours. This is 1977. Whoa. The Cold War is real. There are thousands of thermonuclear missiles headed at every major population center in North America. It is not at all certain we get out of 1977 or any of that. So it's not a huge leap to think back to. I mean, I lived through this. I was a teenager when these things were shot off. So what message would President Trump send on a interstellar mission that would leave today? We have a different kind of existential dread about. The future of our planet for some of the same reasons and some different reasons. So a lot of things have changed since 1977. Many things, sadly, have not. But the fact that it even happened and that people thought about it, and lots of really smart people of goodwill were willing to devote a lot of time and energy to make this thing happen, from picking what was going to go on, recording the greetings, making the records themselves. They were going to approach one record manufacturer and then discovered that they only had one track on the disc and maybe they weren't actually going to spend time making the physical thing. So they went to a different record company to make the physical discs to be sent. There were a lot of pieces in this, and a lot of people said, oh, that sounds like a great idea. Let's do that. And it's just it's a great thought experiment to poke through. What would we do today? How would this be done today? It would be done very differently. It'd be crowdsourced. It'd be, you know, this is the sort of thing that Elon Musk would do instead of Carl Sagan or right. Jeff Bezos. And you get a very different, if this was privately financed, if this was, you know, primarily a commercial thing instead of a scientific thing. And the one, you know, in researching this and looking at the records and the messages and so on, the lasting message that I get is one of hope, is that this is done. I think about these things in documentary forms. It's a mixtape, sure. It's a scrapbook. It's a love letter. It's all kinds of things. But it's a message in a bottle. And you only throw a message in a bottle in the ocean if you think you have no other choice. Or you don't ever think it's ever going to be found, but you want to tell the world something, but maybe you don't want to tell the world something. And so if it's a message in a bottle, that's desperation. This is hope. This is, we're going to get through this. We're going to have a future, and we want to be understood. We want to be remembered and understood, and that's one of the most basic of human things.
Is that why you think this golden record is such an important document? I mean, we're not talking about it necessarily because it's just such an interesting thing. You think it's an important document.
I do, and primarily for what it stands for. I mean, it's a time capsule of what people thought was interesting music in 1977, almost entirely. Well, they tried really hard to represent the whole world, but as far as I can tell, there's no music written by women, for example. It's a lot of Bach. I have no argument with Bach. There's a lot of Bach. And the images are a little strange, but they're all kind of clip art, basically, or, you know, stock footage kind of thing. And the one poor guy eating a grilled cheese sandwich across all of eternity.
Grilled cheese sandwich.
Yeah, I think it's okay. Grilled cheese. It's hard to tell. Next to a woman eating a chicken leg. So I don't know which one you'd rather be. But it's just, it is such an expression of we have a story to tell. We always do. I think of this in very much the same way I think of the handprints you see on cave walls that we don't fully understand. I mean, nobody else is going to be able to make any sense out of those. We have stories to tell, and we want people to hear those stories, and we want to be remembered when it's all said and gone. When we go, the only thing that's left behind is the records we leave behind. Yeah. And this is the record we're all going to leave behind.
I only have about a minute left with you, but I want to know what you would put on a golden record. If you were asked to make one today, what would you put on it?
Yeah,
you're scratching
oh
your head.
God, these are terrible questions to which I don't have a good answer. I was surprised. So I do happen to be a classical music fan, and there's nothing from The Planets, which I don't know. It doesn't even seem like they considered it. They thought of Mendelssohn. There's only one Mozart piece. There's only Queen of the Night. I think classical music tastes have changed over the last 40 years. I'd put Jupiter. Jupiter's my favorite movement of the planets. It's in a major key. Jupiter, the bringer of jollity. It's joyous. It's exuberant. Every time I hear it, I feel better. So if I wanted to send one thing out to the stars, I'd send them how Gustav Holst thought about Jupiter, and maybe make the aliens feel better for a little while.
Joe Janes, associate professor at the Information School at the University of Washington, host of the podcast Documents That Change the World. Thank you so much for talking with me.
Oh, thank you.
This has been The Record from KUOW. I'm Jeannie Yandel. See you back here tomorrow.